You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
We've been in the Psalms this summer. We're going to be in a similar place to where Jared started us out. Something about confidence, something about prayer, seeking. Well, in the Psalms, a lot of times we kind of associate them with joyful, triumphant anthems. But if you've been reading along with us this summer, you'll notice there's a lot of downer psalms. This is easily, I think, the fifth psalm we've preached this summer that has to deal with anxiety, fear, negative emotions. Here we are, again, anxiety and fear. This one feels very triumphant, but underneath it, there's some real fear and anxiety going on. So let's define terms. What is fear? Y'all kind of, maybe it's obvious. Fear is an emotional reaction to an observable threat, a real threat. Our senses activate, there's a real threat. Anxiety is hard to grasp, right? It's kind of in the ether. It's often future-oriented, but it's based around potential threats. Not just real threats, it's potential threats. To illustrate this, my wife and I lived in northern India early in our marriage. And in India, not Indiana, India, there are monkeys everywhere. And your first thought is like, this is so cute. No, you're wrong. They're horrible. They're mean, they're terrible, they terrorize. Monkeys stink. And one beautiful morning, I had gotten up early. It was a fall morning. It was lovely, and I had made coffee. I had gotten to have some time with the Lord. I set my bucket of hot water on the stove to heat up for my bucket bath in a few minutes. Sat down to read, and you know that feeling that you have when you just know somebody else is in the room, but I know Darby's asleep. That just it's maybe a sense, maybe the sixth one. The next thing I know, another sense gets activated. My hearing, there's a screech, a hiss right next to me. And I turn, and with my eyes, I see an alpha male, probably 60-pound monkey, which monkeys are about 4 times stronger than humans, pound for pound. This is a huge, strong, hissing monkey about 2 feet from my chair in my house. This is fear. I black out. The next thing I know, my chair is on the ground. My heart is pounding. My blood is pumping. I'm terrified. My senses tell me there's a real danger. That's fear. Anxiety is the feeling I was left with for the next month. Yeah? There's not a monkey right there. I can't sense it, but I feel this threat on my life. I'm surely gonna die young from a monkey attack. My pockets are full with rocks. I have a stick everywhere I go. This is anxiety, right? A response to a potential threat. So I feel not okay. Well, there's 3 common tendencies that we have in dealing with our anxiety and our fear. Person A knows exactly what they're anxious about. You could tell me right now, yeah? The symptom Googler. You know who you are? The weather app refresher? I need something to tell me that it's 109 degrees outside? The stock market checker? Yeah, email always refreshing. To-do list maker. Person B won't acknowledge at all what they're anxious about. Running around, fills every non-busy moment searching for the next hit of dopamine, the next project to fill up. Maybe the next college football recruit for your team. The next show. Life is a constant doing and going and looking elsewhere than what's underneath. And then person C is actually all of us, which is some of both. We know what we're anxious about, and we actually won't really acknowledge how anxious and fearful we really are. And we won't quite ask the question, what's underneath it? What's underpinning all of this anxiety. Anxiety and fear are really complex, and the Bible deals with them in a whole bunch of different ways. And in this psalm, we actually see David do something really interesting in his fear. He has what? Confidence, courage. We see something different. He deals with his fear in a unique way. You see what he says in verse 4? By gazing upon the beauty of the Lord. What does it mean? How do we do it? That's what we're going to look at today. So three questions. What is David facing? How does he face it? What's the result? What happens? Let's look at verse 1. Open it up. If you haven't already, open it up. Pull it up on your phone. Bring that Bible. Verse 1. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? These are two statements about being not afraid. Like he acts like he's not afraid. Why are we talking about fear? The only reason that you bring up two times that you're not afraid is there's really fearful things happening. He's telling himself and us not to be afraid, self-talk, because of God, who God is. But he's talking about real circumstances that are fearful. Go down to verse 2. When evildoers assailed me to eat up my flesh, these are real things that happened to him. My adversaries and foes, it's they who stumble and fell. Though an army encamped against me, they camped out to kill me. My heart did not fear. The war rose up against me, yet I will be confident. Verse 10, my father and mother have forsaken me. Verse 12, give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses, or think slanderers, have risen against me, and they do what? Breathe out violence. David shares some of the worst experiences he's actually had. Fearful, real experiences. I don't know the last time that you had been chased out to a desert with 3,000 men of your own people, and then 12,000, his best friend's dad and his own son, his best friend Ahithophel, betrayed him. They were out to tear him apart. What is David telling us? He's telling us something we already know. Life is full of fear and anxiety. Earth to Jordan, I know that. Yes, we know this, but we don't often reflect on this enough to actually see what's happening underneath it. How do we deal with it effectively? One of my favorite thinkers, Ernest Becker, wrote in his book, Denial of Death. I'll read this slowly. I think that taking life seriously means that whatever man does on this planet has to be done in the lived truth of the terror of creation. In the lived truth of the terror of creation. Of the rumble of panic underneath everything. Or else it's false. What are we to make of a creation in which the routine activity is for organisms to be tearing others apart? With teeth, all types of biting, grinding flesh, plant stalks, bones between molars, everyone reaching out to incorporate others who are edible to him. David had faced fear to the nth degree. A dog-eat-dog world. He faced the terror of being human, of being puny and vulnerable. He says in verse 2, literally, he says, people are out to do what? Eat up my flesh. Consume me. Take over. This is the lived truth of the terror of creation. And the reason that fear is so pervasive is because fearful situations are real. They're horrible. The horrible circumstances happen. It doesn't take much for our busy lives to come to a screeching halt. An injury, feeling our bodies breaking down, sickness, financial loss, betrayal, one of our children struggling, a breakup. One microscopic virus has absolutely brought the world to a halt for a couple months, for months on end. Like Ernest Becker said, we live in a dangerous world that we can't control. And we're susceptible to being torn apart. And David does not downplay that. He is not whitewashing that. And neither should we. We like to think we have far more capacity to preserve and protect ourselves than we really do. Our homes make us feel safe. The nest. Our savings accounts make us feel secure. Our exercise, low-carb diet, and essential oils, they make us feel strong. I have an answer for this problem. The legacy or the business that we're building, it makes us feel like we matter. Ernest Becker calls all these things immortality projects, ways in which we are trying to live forever. But let's ask, how are these working out for us? Are they doing well? Are they helping? Am I just running around in the hustle and bustle of anxiety? Is it the rumble of panic under everything actually sweeping me with it? We're not as safe and secure and strong as we like to think. The truth is, life is fragile. We're fragile. And that messes with us. That messes with our core. But David does not deny the fragility of life. He lays it right out there. Verse 2, evildoers assailed me. They came at me. Not like on Twitter, don't at me, bro. No, they assailed him. They were chasing him down to kill him. Verse 3, an entire army camped out against him. War was rising. Verse 5, there's a real day of trouble. Verse 6, enemies are all around me. Verse 12, false witnesses have risen up against me. This is the terror of creation that David knows firsthand. He knows life is fragile. And yet David faces his fear with confidence, with courage. Look at verse 3. Though an army encamped against me, I shall not fear. Though war rose up against me, in this I will be confident. How does he have that kind of courage and confidence in the face of his fear? How does he face these fears? Let's look down at verse 4. One thing have I asked of the Lord, that only will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. To do what? To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple, to wonder, to meditate. One thing I asked of the Lord. David prays for a lot of things in the Psalms. He wrote 73 of those 150. He prays for all kinds of things. But here, he's chosen one thing that rises up above all the other needs. The one thing that he needs in the face of his fear. One Hebrew scholar notes that this is actually like a really intense way of repetition. He's saying, I need one singular thing only. One. It's really intense. He's kind of yelling it at us. He's completely single-minded. What is the one thing that you want when you're anxious? Like, what's the first thing you go to when you're feeling afraid? Think about it. Like, really, what's the one? What is it? David's one thing is what? To be with God. More than he wants to be saved from his enemies and the armies that are against him. He wants to be with God, and not just to be with him, but to gaze on his beauty, to wonder at who he is and what he's like. Let's look back at one. Let's read it one more time. One thing have I asked, that only will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire or meditate in his temple. I don't know about you, but I would ask for my situation to change. That's the first thing that comes to mind. Like, how about get rid of these armies? Get me out of this mess. But that is not what David says. He says, God, come and be with me in this mess. Think about when a young child is afraid. What do they do first? They run looking for their mom or dad's legs to grasp around. They run past a bunch of other legs. Why are those not good enough to protect them? Why do they need mama's legs or their dad's legs? It's not first for protection, because legs are not very good at that, are they? It's because they want the person. It is the relationship that brings them the safety and security that they long for. It's about attachment. It's about connection. It's about nearness. David wants to run past everything else that's offered for comfort, and he wants to run to his God to take hold of him. He elaborates on this request. Look down at verse 7. Look down there. He requests a bunch of things. Let's see what the heart of those are. Verse 7. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud. Be gracious to me. Answer me. You said, seek my face. Your face, Lord, is what I'm seeking. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger, O you who have been my help. Cast me not off. Forsake me not, O God of my salvation. Verse 11. Teach me your way, O God, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. Give me not over to the will of my adversaries. What he's saying is, don't abandon me. Don't bail on me. Don't let go. Do you see all those requests? Hear me, be gracious to me, respond to me, teach me, lead me. Don't hide your face, but show it to me. Don't reject me. Don't leave. In other words, be with me. Abide with me. Don't let me be here alone. In order to deal with that terror of creation, the fragility of life, what's David's answer? The one thing he needs is fellowship with God. Communion with the living God. Attachment, attunement, friendship, nearness. Connection with God. And let's notice those words in verse 4 that he uses. There's three words. Dwell, gaze, meditate, inquire, wonder. These are things that take time. They're slow. You remember the last time you gazed at something? What is gazing? It's to look with purpose, to look to admire, to remember. Do you remember the intricacies of someone's eyes? When was the last time you gazed at a setting? These take time. It requires us to slow down. Maybe even offer a sacrifice of our real attention. Dallas Willard, when asked what the greatest enemy of the spiritual life is, you know what he said? Hurry. Hurry. And we must ruthlessly eliminate it. I'm in such a hurry, traveling at unhuman speeds, doing way too much. How am I to have fellowship with God in such a distracted hurry? What David says is he needs to get lost in time with God. Dwell, gaze, meditate. And he says that it's his beauty that will deal with it. Beauty is a powerful thing, isn't it? It captivates us. We long for it. We go to concerts. We go to museums. We travel across the world. We go look at mountains. We paint. We read stories. We're searching for beauty. We will spend crazy amounts of time and energy looking for just a fleeting moment of it. Something beautiful can change your mood, can't it? It can change your life, the trajectory of it. Dostoevsky wrote, "It is beauty that will change the world." Have you ever been changed by beauty? Of course you have. You've been to a concert, that wall of sound that just shuts off the rumble of panic for just a moment. The beauty of a friend's smile when you've been anxiously waiting to see someone, a face that you recognize. A stunning sunset after a brutal workday. For you parents out there, is there anything more beautiful on earth than watching your child sleep? No. They could be sick, having a horrible day, been a turkey all day long, but is there anything more beautiful than the peace and calm and countenance changing sleep of a child? No, absolutely not. The American Journal of Public Health compiled research about the connections between art and our physiological and psychological health, our healing. You might guess, they found that engaging with art in any way, any form, as the creator or the beholder, either side, almost always lowers anxiety and stress. Almost always. It even drastically lowers heart rates for patients in the hospital dealing with heart disease. It lowers pain levels of cancer patients. The studies go on and on. It's clear. Beauty changes us. It didn't matter if they were painting or woodworking or dancing or driving in scenic drives or enjoying a ballet or walking, being led through a museum. It is almost ubiquitous with our healing. If our physiology and our mental health can experience tastes of wholeness, if that can be true, just from a few minutes a day of listening, active listening to music, how much more will our bodies, our minds, and our souls be changed and restored by beholding God? When David says, "One thing I ask is to do what? Gaze upon his beauty." This is not like a cliche. This is not escapism from the world. This is real help in a time of need. Real deep healing and hope. So what are the practical ways that we gaze upon his beauty? Jared talked about it. We come to him. We open ourselves to him, right? We could pray. We could actually do that. We can, as you might know, look at his creation. His creation reveals his beauty. Psalm 8 says, his beauty fills the earth. His word reveals his beauty. The more that I read the Bible, the more that I take in the intricacies and the images, the symbols and the stories, it changes me, the sheer power of it. It's more than a daily task, but it has become beautiful to me. I invite you, look into his word and his people. Shockingly, his people, those of us who have been given the very image of God, made in his image, actually reveal his beauty. Look at someone next to you. Take a second. Look at someone next to you. Say, "You bear the image of God." Take a second. I want to hear it. We could be those who look in each other's faces and see beauty. Could we not? God has given us this gracious task of seeing him everywhere, of worshiping him always, of testifying to the world that what is seen as beautiful is simply beautiful because it comes from the source of beauty, God himself. Psalm 50 says, "Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines forth." That is why David gazes upon the beauty of God, longs to gaze upon his beauty, because it actually transforms him. It changes him. It heals him. It changes how he reacts in a given moment. It slows him down. And that takes us to our final question. What's the result? What happens? when we seek the presence of God in the face of fear. Let's look down, verse 5 and 6. Look at it. These are these great gifts to us. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. Verse 6, and now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me. And I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. And I will sing and make melody to the Lord. What happens in the day of trouble? When we're exposed to that terror of creation, the lived truth, God hides us in his shelter. When someone takes you to their home, what are they doing? They're welcoming you into a place of refuge, into a place of protection. You will receive care. You will receive attention. You can rest again. God brings us off the streets where we are overwhelmed, the streets of fear, into peace and quiet, into the quiet of his tent, his own home. When we're overwhelmed with pressure and hardship, and it looks like we're drowning, or feels like we're just barely above water, what does he do? He lifts us high upon a rock. He sets our feet on a solid place above the rising waters. We can breathe. We can sort things out. We can find a way forward. When we feel defeat, God lifts us up above our enemies all around us. He's our vindication and victory. We go from hanging our head to doing what? Shouts of joy and singing. You see the transformation. You see it there. As David seeks to dwell with God and gaze on his beauty, his countenance is changing. His confidence is growing. What do we do with our bodies when we're fearing, when we're experiencing fear and anxiety? What happens? Think about it. Our heads fall. We often do what? We navel gaze. We think inwardly. Our heads fall. But what happens when we gaze on God's beauty? The result is our heads are lifted. We stand. Our posture changes. We sing and we shout, as we already have today. In the presence of God, David experiences a kind of resurrection, doesn't he? From despair and death to courage, confidence, even delight in life. We may think that we're drawn to beauty just because it makes us feel good. And it does. But that's not it. We're drawn to beauty because it changes us. John Piper says it like this. No one goes to the Grand Canyon to increase their self-esteem. So why do we go? Beholding beauty and glory isn't about bolstering our sense of self. It's also not about making us smaller, but it's more about seeing ourselves in the context of a greater glory, of a grander narrative, a bigger history. We see our fragility. We question our significance. We see our need, and we can see the God of greatness and majesty is also a God who pays attention to the smallest of details, to the deepest of longings. He might not be a personalized God, how we want him to be, but he is a personal God. Beholding beauty helps us to make sense of our very existence. And I think that's actually why, if you look through and you count it up, David uses the word the Lord. In Hebrew, it's Jehovah this time. Jehovah, 13 times in as many verses. Why do you think he does that? Jehovah means the ever-existent one. David sees that our existential angst, our fear, our anxiety actually dissolve as we gaze upon the beauty, upon the majesty of the ever-existent one. There's a film came out in 1998 called Life is Beautiful. Alberto Benigni. It was about an Italian Jew during the Holocaust named Guido. Guido was an absolutely lovable character. And this is based on a true story. He's a waiter. He falls in love with a school teacher named Dora. They have a son named Josue. And at Josue's birthday one year, they are captured and sent off to a concentration camp. In the camp, Guido and Dora end up getting separated. And while Guido keeps his son from the imminent death, most of the children had been taken. He hides him, and he convinces his son that the whole camp is just a game. It's a very complicated, intricate game. And if Josue will remain silent, quiet, and hidden from the officers, day after day, he'll win his own military tank. Exactly what my boys would love. Throughout their imprisonment, Guido pulls off all these different kinds of stunts. He's trying to send messages to his wife, Dora, to lift her hope, to remind her, to tell her they're still alive, even though they can't see one another. And one of those messages he sends, he risks his life to play a song by Offenbach, a record, over the intercom, over the loudspeaker. And as he does it, it doesn't just shift the countenance of and the hopes of his wife. It changes everyone in the camp. The beauty of the music had just this wide impact. For everyone in the camp, that beautiful music burst against the harsh realities, the devastating life that was their existence. It raises spirits. It lifted heads. Life, courage, and delight floods the camp. It's amazing. The beauty that Guido brought into the camp is a major reason many of them survived and were able to sustain. Pastor Charles Drew explains it like this. Imagination, courage, and beauty combine as a mighty assault upon the great evil. This is what David is testifying to. He's calling us, he's beckoning us, inviting us to see. It is the stunning beauty of a God that speaks much louder than our fear and our anxiety. The lived truth of terror of creation, it gives way to the lived truth of God's beauty. David closes the psalm with this stunning statement of confidence and courage. And he invites us to take heart with him. He believes that God is both deliverer and refuge, and that God will show himself as David seeks him. Look at that, verse 13, look down there. I believe that I will look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. What's the land of the living? Eugene Peterson helps us out. The land of the living is obviously not a vacation paradise. It's more like a war zone. The lived truth, right? But that's where we Christians are stationed, to affirm the primacy of life over death, to give witness to the connectedness, the preciousness of life, and to engage in the practice of resurrection. This is to engage in gazing upon the beauty of the Lord, sharing forth his beauty. The very last verse, verse 14, I kind of imagine David is, he's in his old age and he can't speak too loud anymore because he's sung so many years. He's yelled out so many years. He pulls us in close. Look at it, verse 14. Wait for the Lord. Be strong in him. Take and let your heart take courage. Receive courage. That's the word encourage. It means to put courage within. He says, take it. take this courage from me. Wait for the Lord. And Jesus says almost astonishingly the same thing the night before he was betrayed, or the night he was betrayed at the Last Supper, before he's about himself to be torn apart, to experience the lived truth of the terror of creation. He's torn apart for our sin. He's torn apart for what we're really afraid of, our real enemy, death. He says, John 16, I have said these things to you that in me you will have peace. In the world, you will have trouble, tribulation. What does he say? Take heart. Take courage. Take hope. I have overcome the world. As we see throughout this psalm, Jesus is our shelter. What Paul says, our life is hidden with Christ in God. Jesus is our rock. If we build our lives on him, it will withstand the storms of life. Jesus is the lifter of our heads. He is the victory we long for. The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us victory through Jesus Christ. And when we look at Jesus, what do we see? 2 Corinthians 4, God says, for the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, he has shone into our hearts to give the light of knowledge of the glory of God in the very face of Jesus. He's shown us what he's like in the face of Jesus. Hebrews 1 says, Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God. He's the exact imprint of his nature. We were made in his image. Colossians 1 says, Jesus is the image of God. So when we want to gaze upon him, we look to him in his life, in his death, in his resurrection, in his ascension. And he sends his spirit that we might be with him. Because of Jesus, we can say with confidence today what David said, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.